I'm here with Joel Salatin at the Food and Farm Forum here in Montrose. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
So, I did a little bit of research on you, and it sounds like growing up, your family's farming style was maybe a little bit non-traditional or non-conventional. Do you think that shaped how you farm today?
Oh, absolutely. I'm cut from a really unconventional lunatic cloth. My grandfather, my dad's dad, was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it was launched in, 1949 by Rodale. And so he had a large organic garden and chickens and things like that. A lot of people in this country now don't realize what a watershed that just post-World War II period was, as we moved away from a lot of heritage techniques and embraced the new cheap chemicals that were available as a kind of a result of the extra stockpile of the war effort. And so, there was a healthy group of people. I mean, Lewis Bromfield was one. He was up for Secretary of Agriculture, and he certainly didn't use chemicals. And then he died suddenly. Some people still think he was assassinated, but anyway, I won't go to conspiracy theories. The point is that there was a lot of searching about that post-World War II period of time. And my grandpa came down on the side of the non-chemical. And Dad got it from him. I got it from Dad. And so I'm absolutely, still running that same idea. Today, you have the philosophy or the paradigm, if you will, and then you have the practical outworking of that paradigm. That initial paradigm of we don't use chemicals and we're carbon-based and we're, complex, integrated, multi-speciated based, those kinds of things. What we've done now over the period of time is we've simply refined that and added more species or more efficient ways to a bigger wood chipper, for example, to do carbon, to do larger composting, and added, the chickens behind the cows and more complex symbiotic relationships that just never stops. You never get done, adding additional things. We just had this winter, for example, a new idea. We have a bandsaw mill so we can turn our own logs into lumber we use on the farm. And we've made some 4-foot high tables for the hoop houses. So in the winter, the laying chickens come into tall tunnel hoop houses so they stay warm and water doesn't freeze. You've got all this headroom. You've got chickens on the deep bedding on the floor, but you've got all this headroom. Well, can we use the headroom? And so we've now made 4-foot tall, just wooden tables, 4 by 8 feet, and we can just set them together and essentially make a mezzanine floor. Okay, we put all the chickens up there, and then we can run lambs underneath sheep, and the sheep run on the floor underneath the mezzanine. All the real fragile chicken waterers and feeders and nest boxes and stuff is up on this mezzanine. The chickens can jump up there, and it allows you to get two tiers, two additional production, because now you're using cubic footage and not just linear floor space. So, you never get done refining. There's always another refinement that you can do.
Ain't that the truth? What do you know now that you wish you knew back then?
I would say whenever anybody asks me that kind of question, like what would you do differently or whatever, I think the main thing that I would do differently, which is the Achilles heel of pretty much all farmers, so I'm pretty typical that way, is to appreciate the strength in mutual interdependence and not go so long before finding partners that are strong where I'm weak. The whole business strengths finder idea where, you've been told, well, you're weak in that, you should work on that. The whole strengths finder idea flips that on its head and says, actually, you get a lot farther if you get a partner who is strong where you're weak and let you spend more time honing, refining, and leveraging your strength. And I would say that if I had to do over again, I would have sought and found and developed a team faster so it wasn't just me. And I think that's pretty much true for every small business.
Is that what you're going to be talking about today in your lecture later?
This evening, no. Dancing with Dinner, that's going to be a more consumer-oriented talk about connecting with our food and the whole trend lines of Uberization of food as we move away from, the big box store and start looking at the atomization of things. The industrial economy pushed us to the economies of scale and size. of everything. And, you know, there is a point at which size starts becoming top heavy. We see it in business. We see it in government. We see it in lots of things. And there is a sweet spot. There's a sweet spot of scale for different kinds of businesses in different fields. We've certainly seen it in, for example, the movie industry. You know, 80 years ago, there were just several large film producers, and the average company had whatever it was, you know, 1,000 employees. Today, there are hundreds. You know, everybody that's got an iPhone can produce a movie, right? And hundreds, and the average production team is 10. And so that's a perfect example of kind of the uberization, atomization in the marketplace. The point is that the desire for millennials and for young people to connect with food, connect with their farmer, know their farmer, that pendulum is definitely swinging in favor of atomization within the food system. And so who are you going to dance with? So we've got a changing of partners. We're not just dancing with Kroger anymore. We're dancing with actual, you know, people with a face.
I tried to watch Food, Inc. What's changed for you since you did that film?
That film, Food, Inc., you know, it was up for an award, one of those documentary awards of some sort. I mean, it got traction, and it was a blip on our life, for sure. I mean, I'd already written several books. You know, we had a successful farm. We were, you know, we were in that space, but all I can say is it just made a bigger stage for us. It didn't change our message at all, but it definitely changed our credibility in the idea marketplace. And I'm very aware that I'm an idea salesman. I sell ideas. There's not much money in that, except that if people like your sales pitch, they will hire you to come and listen to your sales pitch, all right? It created a bigger platform for us. It didn't really change actual food sales for us that much. A little, but not a lot. The main thing that it did, it gave us a platform that just gave me a bigger pulpit to preach from, which I'll forever be grateful for. I have a great team. You know, we just keep telling the story and try to be authentic. This space, like anything that starts to gain momentum, people of dubious character are drawn to it, you know, just like televangelism and whatever. And so we see that in this space as well. And we just try to stay true to what we're doing and for sure keep caressing the land the way we always have. Even though we're much bigger than we were, you know, 10 years ago, the protocols are the same. I think actually we do better today than we did 10 years ago because we have better experience, better skill. And I'm confident that our pigs are happier today than they were 10 years ago, just with better technique, better handling, more experience in how to handle them stress-free if you're going to move them or load them or that sort of thing. And so it's very exciting to just to know that every day you can get a little better. You can always get a little better. You know, about 8 years ago, I was speaking so much. I travel and speak a lot. 8 years ago, I remember I was coming back from a trip, and I kind of had an emotional wall. And I said, man, what else is there to talk about? I mean, what am I knowledgeable enough to talk about? Am I going to be stuck with the same phrases, the same words, you know, the rest of my life? And I kind of got this little, like a panic attack, you know, I mean, not totally, but like this little panic attack about, can I continue to grow? And I went home, and a couple of days later, I got a request to go speak at a sustainable energy conference. And I'd never spoken at a sustainable energy conference. You know, we're livestock, land, you know, that wasn't our thing. And, you know, I buckled down and I did a keynote speech. They went nuts over it. And it was like a breakthrough for me. I realized, you know, truth can touch every single facet of the human experience and the human life. And as long as I'm simply applying principles to things, they will always have an application and there will always be a new angle to apply the truth in that type of enterprise, that type of vocation, that type of thing, that country, that different place. And so it really got me over the hump. And now I realize, my goodness, I could never run out of material. You know, there's always new material. I mean, look, if People Magazine can put the Kardashians on the cover for 24 months straight, surely I could come up with new material in food and farming for a while.
You touched on foundational principles. Talk to me about what those are for you.
The foundational principles, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm more a poet than anything. And so as we began looking at how nature works, what we noticed was Every ecology is full of animals. There are animals everywhere. And so this notion that we can have these great big, you know, crop farms with no animals is really assaultive of the natural template. So it has animals. There's a fundamentally integration of animals and plants in nature. You don't see plants over here and animals over here. The animals eat the plants in situ, right? The animals aren't confined in factory houses and all the plants brought into them with fertility generated from, you know, from petroleum. The fertility for the plants comes from the manure and the urine from the animals that are cyclical, okay? And so animals, and then next, animals move. They're not locked up, they actually move, which means we needed mobile control because the neighbors don't want them on their place. We needed mobile shelter, mobile water. Fortunately, we have a polyethylene pipe now so we can get water to any place. And so we use technology, electric fences for control, portable infrastructure. We have all sorts of portable shelters. We have the Millennium Feather Net, the Eggmobile, the Gobbledygo for the turkeys, the Lamborghini for the sheep. I mean, there's all sorts of this portable infrastructure. But, you know, 100 years ago, you couldn't make it because it was too laborious and expensive to mill wood into small pieces. But today, with little, you know, bandsaw mills, we can essentially make tinker toy stuff lightweight enough to be movable. And so there's a wonderful confluence of technology for control, shelter, and water that didn't exist even 80 years ago. And so it's a wonderful time to be able to duplicate the choreography of nature with this movement pattern. And then, you know, nature doesn't move carbon very far. You know, fertility grows in situ and, you know, leaves blow a little ways. An herbivore eats a plant and goes up on a hilltop and eats it and poops. But, you know, nature doesn't move carbon very far. And so we realize we've got to close our carbon loop. So, you know, we got a big industrial wood chipper and we started working in the woods and chipping diseased and dead and downed and crooked stuff and upgrading the woodlot and weeding it. And that then allowed us to do large-scale composting, which then drove our fertility program. That was in situ. And then we noticed, you know, nature doesn't have very many annuals. It's primarily perennials, not annuals. And so, well, how can we handle more perennials? And so, you know, we moved the farm forward in a perennially-based system as opposed to being, you know, crop folks. I mean, we have big garden and that sort of thing. But we let the folks downhill in the valleys grow the crops, and we bring them up to the animals uphill, and that's the way nature always did. The animals ate in the valleys and then walked up to get to see predators on the hilltop, and that's where they pooped and urinated, and that moved all that gravitational fertility from the valleys, it moved it back up on the hillsides, and that was one of the roles of animals in nature. You know, those were just real simple principles that we looked at our farm and said, how do we duplicate these? And as we did, we started having some tremendous success.
What perennials are you growing?
We're primarily a forest farm. We have a lot more woods than we have open land. And so we do have a sawmill, and we sell lumber and we mill for our own use and things. We sell firewood, you know, so we do a lot of forestry work. And we're opening that up. We run pigs in the woods. They fatten up on acorns, you know, like the old days. But we control them with electric fence. So, you know, there's some high tech as well as old and new married there. But basically the pastures are just whatever will grow. We don't plant anything. We haven't planted anything in 60 years. And it has changed. It's become much more diversified, you know, much more fertile. And we still see new species coming in. You know, they say that all you have to do is plow one time and it takes nature 100 years to bring back in all the species that were there before it was plowed one time. So, you know, we're just at 60 years. You know, it'll take a little while to get back to all those. But we're seeing some very ancient old species that actually nobody even knows what they are. And that's pretty cool.
Maybe you could have one named after you.
Oh, maybe so. I don't know.
I have a friend and neighbor who is raising pigs, and he had a specific question about cover crop recommendations for our region.
Yeah, well, there's a couple things to realize. One is that number one thing to do here is to increase the hydration on the landscape. I mean, you're starved for water. So increasing the hydration on the landscape is a big deal, whether it's through irrigation, which, you know, I like ponds, but a permaculture concept is a thing called swales, where you actually make little berms, and they can be as small as a foot, but you essentially make corrugations in the slope that is against the slope. So the water can't just run off a slope. It has to run into little berms, if you will. Think about it like in downward skiing. What's the...
Moguls.
The moguls, yeah. Think about it. I'm not from ski country. Think about it as mogul landscape development, so that the water has to slow down, and that gives the water time to penetrate. And around the world in dry places, this technique, it can do the equivalent of doubling rainfall, which is a big deal to double rainfall. And so back to the pigs then, if the pigs are fenced with their paddocks against the slope, perpendicular to the slope, then the pigs will always berm up. They'll root and they'll berm up around your electric fence and stuff. And that's an easy way to quickly berm. And if you make those fairly narrow, you know, 12-foot strips, for example, and go up a hillside, you can actually do almost a poor man terrace. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
And I think few landscape features are as beautiful as terraces. I just think they're gorgeous. And they take what normally would be completely unproductive and make it incredibly productive. So the pigs can be used to actually move the landscape to a more water retentive capacity over time if you strategically fence them so that your fences are running on berms that you want to automatically create.
Smart. And pigs are smart, they say.
Oh yeah, pigs are the smartest farm animal. There's no doubt about it. That's why they're the most aggravating. Goats are the most mischievous. But goats are not as smart as a pig. Goats just get into trouble. Pigs would be worse than goats, but they spend too much time sleeping. So if goats slept as much time as a pig, they wouldn't get into so much trouble. But the problem with goats is they don't sleep. And so they're just always getting into trouble. Pigs spend, you know, a happy pig will normally spend, 15, 16 hours a day sleeping. So, you know, they're the last animal up in the morning. Chickens are the first one up. And then cows and sheep and goats and then pigs. Pigs are the last one.
And then the farm cat.
Yeah, the farm cat never gets up. But yeah, if you're a late riser, you might have been a pig in a previous life.
Anything else you want to talk about with your pigs?
The only thing I'll say about pigs is the number one problem I see in pastured pigs around the world is that people leave them too long at too high a density and do too much damage and not a long enough rest period. Listen, nobody loves the pastured pig concept and doing it as much as I do, but it is a land extensive thing. Now, the beauty of pastured pigs is you don't have to build a house and you don't have to haul poop, all right? So those are big positives. But the negative is that you can't just translate that density of pig in a house with, you know, deep bedding, some sort of a shed or a barn or whatever. You can't just translate that density outside. Or you're gonna moonscape thing. You're gonna just tear it up, and it's gonna be an ecological disaster. So what most people don't realize is how much land it takes. And even in our country, you know, we're only running about 10 pigs per acre. You know, now rotated. You know, they're only on a given spot maybe 5 to 10 days at a time, and then you take them off and you rest it for 60 or 70 days. In this country, you know, maybe you would drop that to 3. And a rest period of 100 days. I don't know. But that's where you have to look at the vegetation, at the ground cover that you want, and then you simply monitor it and you offer the level of disturbance and rest. Disturbance and rest. I mean, it took us, 6 or 7 years to finally arrive at a formula that worked in our ecology, in our climate, in our terrain. And so it'll take somebody here. The formula hasn't been worked out here. And so it just takes some time to monitor and figure out what that is.
Your latest book is on pigs, right?
No, The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs is not about pigs. It's essentially honoring and respecting all of God's creation as if it actually matters. And so it's a fun way to get people to appreciate that it does matter if pigs can express their pigness. That's a very stewardship-oriented thing. You know, in our culture right now, we don't ask how to make happy pigs. We ask how can we grow them faster? How can we grow them fatter? How can we grow them cheaper? All the fatter, faster, bigger, cheaper. You know, these are the goals. And we don't ask, well, does it matter if the pigs are happy? And in this book, it's essentially it's ecological stewardship for the religious right, if you will. And I would suggest that a culture that refuses to ask, how do we grow happy pigs, will very soon not ask, how do we grow happy people? How do we have happy children? Asking that question creates a moral imperative around our scientific prowess. And, you know, one of our problems as a culture, I think, especially a very highly sophisticated technological culture, is that we're very good about how to. We can solve almost anything, but as technicians, we're not drilling down on the why. So we can do things. My dad used to call this overrunning our headlights. We can create things that we can't morally, physically, emotionally, or mentally metabolize. And so we create things like feeding dead cows to cows for 30 years. And then we have bovine spongiform encephalopathy. That was very creative, how to grind up a cow and feed it back to a cow in a way that a cow would eat, that an herbivore would eat carrion. Wow, that's very creative. But it was completely against the cowness of the cow. And I was laughed at for 30 years for daring to question progressive science and what we can do until the day we had Mad Cow. And then suddenly, I wasn't so stupid anymore. And I didn't oppose it, not because I hated science or didn't want progress. I opposed it because I looked around the planet and said, where's the herbivore that eats carrion? I mean, at her most fundamental state, a cow is an herbivore. She's not just inanimate protoplasmic structure to be manipulated, however clever Huber's can imagine to manipulate it. She's a cow, you know, and she's an herbivore. And so order, natural order design, that should act as a boundary, if you will, over what we can do. The movie Jurassic Park, you know, everything's going into mayhem. And the scientist, of course, civilization's getting ready to be destroyed. He's still euphoric over his development. And the journalist, of course, you know, as a writer, I have a very soft heart for journalists, okay? The journalist, you know, gets in the scientist's face. He says, but sir, just because we can, should we? That is the pregnant statement of the entire movie. That is the deal. And I think we as a culture don't ask ourselves that much. We just say, how can we do this? We don't ask, well, should we?
I asked Joel his take on urban farming, and specifically how someone, perhaps even a newer farmer, could utilize a small plot of land for small-scale farming.
Very small acreage farms are absolutely viable today. I would say perhaps the most viable they've ever been in history, because we do have drip tape irrigation. We have broad forks. We have, you know, transplant things. We have hoop houses. Goodness, I ran into a guy from Kenya who had gotten a bunch of salvaged 24-inch culverts and cut them in 12-foot pieces and took an acetylene torch and torched pockets in them, tamped them full of soil and compost, and planted cabbage and Brussels sprouts in these pockets on these 24-inch vertical tubes. He was essentially growing, I think it was 25 acres worth of broccoli and cabbage on 1 acre of land. And he had a little drip tape, you know, in the top of each one. We have not been able to do that in history. And so the ability to have these extremely intensive, stackable, companion planting techniques now makes actually small acreages. I mean, this was, there's actually a name for this developed in British Columbia called spin farming. It's all about under like 2 acre farms. And it's absolutely a trend that's moving in the urban sector and in the near urban fringe. And we can just be really thankful that we have water delivery systems and season extension systems that are so far beyond a bucket and a cold frame that we had, you know, 80 years ago.
You said 70% of all food on the planet is produced on farms smaller than 10 acres.
Yeah, that's correct. We tend to think these big, you know, great big farms are where everything is produced, but that's not the case. I mean, in Italy, the average farm is 7.5 acres, and that's why all the walk-behind tillers, a little like BCSs, little garden tractors, they're all made in Italy, because that's the tractor of a very small acreage. And you can make round bales and mow hay and rake and basically everything that you can do with a great big tractor with a little hand tractor. And of course, Africa, Central America, most places, a lot of this food's produced there. I mean, as recently as 1946, 40% of all produce in America was grown in backyard gardens in 1946. That's not that long ago. And so in the uberization of the food system, part of it is going to be the uberization of the farming system too, that with this really cool technology we have now with little, you know, walk behind tractors and tillers and the kind of stuff that Ben Hartman is doing, the kind of stuff that Elliot Coleman has been doing. We're seeing now increased viability for small space food production occupation. At our farm, we have these all this portable, you know, the egg mobiles and the portable chicken shelters and stuff. And I know people that have a quarter acre suburban backyard, and they have one of these chicken shelters, and they move the chickens around in the yard. They produce their own food. They become the number one babysitter for all the kids in the community. They get off the bus. They don't go watch cartoons on TV. Now they run and they sit on 5 gallon buckets and watch the chickens, you know. And so there's all these cool social community connections that develop when we bring food proximate to consumption. The amount of slippage, we call it slippage, you can call it waste, you can call it muda, which is a Japanese word, but it's all speaking to the same thing, that the amount of slippage, spoilage and all that can be minimized as you move down in scale. At industrial scale, the value of one is, who cares, it's just one among, you know, thousands. But if you're just producing 10, the value of one becomes important. And so you tend to exercise more care, as you said, more TLC per plant or per animal or whatever, and you simply can do more. I mean, we gather eggs by hand. Who gathers eggs by hand? We gather, you know, 200 dozen eggs by hand every day, all right? But in a great big factory farm with 100,000 chickens laying on a metal cage floor that goes onto a conveyor, and they're never touched by a human hand from the chicken to the box, that sounds efficient, but if you look at the numbers that get stuck at the 90 degree turn and they're stuck going down and the shells break and there's a huge amount of breakage. I was actually in Colorado here at a large organic produce farm, and I went out with the workers, and it was like a 40-foot wide picking crew. They were going through, you know, with this real slow moving, and everybody, you know, we were picking zucchinis and putting them on a conveyor. They went up. Then there was another group of people up on this big shelf, and they were sorting. And I was just almost sick with the amount that they were leaving. But, you know, if you're walking through the field and a machine is up there and you miss picking that zucchini, you can't run back 10 feet, and now you're going to have to run 20 feet to catch up to the machine. And so the machine grinds on. And the amount of waste in that field, to my intuitive eye, it seemed almost like wasting as much as they were picking. You know, and the fact is we do waste about 50%, almost 50% of the human edible food on the planet. You know, in my garden, goodness, I don't miss any zucchini. I get them all. Well, unless I miss one and then it, you know, takes over the house next week. You know, they say in the country, the only time you have to lock your car is in July to keep the neighbors from putting runaway zucchini squash in it. And even the stuff that got like that, we've got chickens we can feed it to. We've got pigs we can feed it to. And so nothing goes to waste. And so these closed loop senses, that's one of the things, another principle that you see in nature is that there is no waste. They don't have landfills. Everything has a place. Something's always coming in, eating the waste stream of the previous cycle. And that's a fact of ecology.
It's a good model to follow.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it takes work. You know, it means that at the church potluck, you dare to ask, do we really need to use styrofoam? Or can we use paper? Or can we go down to the Salvation Army thrift store and buy a bunch of cast-off plates and wash them and not have anything to throw away? You know, those kind of questions need to penetrate. We kind of have this default position that we'll always have the landfill, we'll always have plenty of resource. And I'm not opposed to using resource, but goodness, let's use them as judiciously and gently as we possibly can so that our children have a chance to have the same life we did.
Yeah, absolutely. I also heard you say in the next 15 years, 50% of America's agriculture equity is going to change hands. Will you elaborate? Because this is fascinating.
Sure. Well, what that means is right now, the average American farmer is 60 years old. And that age has been going up about 3 to 4 months a year for the past 20 to 25 years. It's just been gradually growing. In Japan, it's even worse. It's 70 years old in Japan. They lead the world in the farmer, you know, what's the average age of the average farmer? If the average age is 60, that means half are already over 60, okay? And so by 75, they're going to be, and a lot of them are over 65, over 70. So in the next 15 years, 50% of the buildings, the land, and the equipment in agriculture will be owned by someone else. That has never happened in any civilization in peace. It's only happened in conquest. Now, I'm not here predicting we're going to be in conquest. I am just suggesting, though, that this is an epochal disruption in the agrarian sector of a culture. The obvious question is, well, where's it going to go? Now, obviously, most of it will be inherited, but it will be inherited by children who don't want to farm. And so then what will happen then? Do they sell it? Does it get leased to Monsanto or Cargill or you know, whatever? I don't know. I can only tell you what I would like to see. I would like to see it go to a new generation of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed entrepreneurial millennials who will take that land and caress it like it hasn't been caressed for a long time and market integrity, nutrient-dense food to their locales and heal the land and heal the communities. I was in Utah 2 weeks ago and did a kind of a town meeting with several politicians. And I asked one of the senators, how much of the food eaten in Utah is produced in Utah? And the official number is 3%. Iowa, perhaps the most fertile agriculture land in the world, only 5% of what's eaten in Iowa is grown in Iowa. 5%. The number one agriculture commodity in Utah is exported alfalfa under irrigation, alfalfa to California dairy farmers and Wagyu producers in Japan. Now, I don't want to run all the alfalfa farmers out of business, but wouldn't it make more sense if a state like Utah, Colorado, whatever, if some of this land were diversified into the food that the communities are eating, and so all of those dollars, including processing dollars, cooking dollars, value-added dollars, could stay within those communities. No community has ever lasted long-term when it couldn't feed itself. And so what we're doing in most of our agriculture communities, we're growing stuff that you can't eat. And then we're importing stuff from distances in order to eat. This just doesn't make intuitive sense. Now, I'm not a prepper and I'm not saying the world's going to collapse tomorrow. But if you look at history, what you see very quickly is that the most secure, resilient communities are communities that have a functional food shed and fiber shed within that community over time. In modern America, edible food is not grown. You go out and get corn and soybeans, and you can get irrigated alfalfa, maybe, but you can't actually get food, human food. And so I think there's a lot of strength in just living in a system where you are able to feed yourself, at least the staples. Now, you know, we're not going to grow bananas in Colorado, but you can actually survive a couple years without bananas. So an exercise that I like to do with people at a seminar, I'll say, take out a piece of paper. Think about walking down the supermarket aisle. You're down at the grocery store. I want you to write down everything that you're seeing on the shelves that could be grown here. It's a huge list. Why can't we grow that here? At least the lion's share of it. I'm not a cultish on this, but let's grow most of it. And let's patronize our own farms. Let's turn those dollars over in our community and create these economies around food and stewardship that are truly secure and resilient, because the chain of custody between earthworm and microbiome is short.
One of the things I loved that you said earlier was you said healthy emotionally and in relationship. Mm-hmm. So maybe just share from your heart on what that means to you.
Yeah, well, you know, you go to a farm conference like this, and it's all wonderful. We're talking about producing food and selling food and that sort of thing, and it's all wonderful. But at the end of the day, if the home is not a happy place to go into, I don't care how big your cabbage is or how well your tractor runs, if the home is not a haven, nothing else matters. And so when we talk about healthy farmers, the tragedy is right now, actually worldwide, the single highest vocational suicide rate in the world is farmers. That's a tragedy. I mean, look at the lore, the poetry, the legacy of the pastoralist. I mean, it's this wonderful, stress-free, you know, life. And what have we done to ourselves that we have put this level of stress on us? So tending those relationships. So in our family, we have monthly family meetings, because the truth is, you know, family relationships and beyond family, of course, in any relationship, we do say unfit words. We, as Stephen Covey in Seven Habits of Highly Effective People talks about the emotional gas tank. And I think that's such a wonderful metaphor, that we're having to put enough emotional gas in each other's tanks that when we make that occasional withdrawal, and we will, that we don't empty the tank. And I have a friend that we teach a business school together, Steve Kenyon, and he has this wonderful thing where he says, I wake up in the morning and I think about the people I'm going to interact with that day and tell myself, goody, this is a day I can put emotional equity in their tank. And that's such a wonderful way to think. If we could think about that with our marriages, our families, our kids. And this idea of happiness, health, of emotional, relational vibrancy, it actually takes as much thought and attention as how to have a healthy chicken or a happy pig or a healthy tomato plant. It really does. And I think that we short ourselves, especially in the ag community, because we're so cotton-picking independent, right? And we short ourselves in not being willing to open up about these relational, emotional issues. And so we push them down inside, we push them down inside. And then over time, the kids resent chores, mom and dad resent this, mom resents dad for being, you know, a hard nose, dad resents mom for being a softy. I mean, there's a million different permutations of this. And so our monthly family meeting where we talk, it's not always business. It's let's clear up something. Let's get the perception. Well, I was thinking this. I'm sorry. I didn't have any idea you would have thought that. But, oh, you did think that? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I can see now why you would have thought that. Right? And because the truth is that unexpressed expectations are the quickest way for relationships to go sideways. If I have expectations, if I'm expecting you to do something, if I don't tell you, I can't help it if you don't do it, you know. So you can only be responsible for the expectations that you know. And so we've got to be upfront with each other about expectations, and that helps to keep things running smoothly.
I think that's universal in any industry, in any
absolutely
relationship. And thank you for sharing all of that. I have some fun questions. Which do you enjoy more, farming or writing?
Oh, man, that is so hard. Do I have to answer this question? I'm just so blessed that as a farmer, I have this gift and an outlet for this creative verbal side of me. I mean, I'm a storyteller, and to be able to combine the two is just wonderful. You know, some people ask me, which animal do you like best, cows? But, you know, I don't. I like it. They all have their thing. And look, I wouldn't want to just be a writer. And I'm perfectly happy to be a farmer. But if I were a farmer and not writing at all, I definitely would not be expressing my joelness. I come at it honestly. In third grade, my dad and mom go to the PTA meeting, right? Third grade, meet my third grade teacher. And my teacher greets, you know, oh, you're Mr. Salazan, okay. She said, oh, I've got one thing to tell you. You have no secrets. So I've been working on this storytelling thing a long, long time. And it's just a blessing to be able to share that. Yeah, it really is.
What can we expect to see from you and Polyface Farms in 2019?
2019, we're on a tear right now. I mean, you know how life is not just a linear. It's a step, 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 step. This is a step year for us. We have had about four significant potential markets come to us over the last 6 weeks. So we're going to be increasing production, especially on poultry and eggs, chickens and eggs, substantially this year, which means we have to deal with, you know, well, logistics, brooders, I mean, just all the infrastructure, and maybe even a little more personnel to do that. And so that's a big deal. We have some neat initiatives going on for farm events, for things there. We have Temple Grandin coming May 29th for a day on the farm with Temple Grandin, and that's very exciting. I have two books in the works that these will be the first two that I'm co-authoring. One is a Polyface design book. One of our former apprentices was well into a career as a Cracker Jack engineer with, I think, General Electric or Westinghouse, and left that to come and apprentice with us. And he really has a desire to get all of our infrastructure that we've invented to where people can build it themselves. So he's going to design it. I'll write the text, so it'll be a co-authored. The other one, book that I'm working on almost every day right now, because we're working on it together, is a biochemist with a proficiency in nutrition. She's a PhD and ate the standard American diet and got so sick she almost died. I mean, like her five-year-old son had to bring her glasses of water lying on the floor because she couldn't get up. They started preparing for a funeral. She got autoimmune disorder and just completely debilitated and thought she was going to die. She used her biochemistry to start doing research and research and research. Make a long story short, she now is a vibrant go-getter, unbounded energy, cured herself all through diet, food. And so we're wanting to do a book. It was her idea. I can't claim the idea, but she came to me and approached me about co-authoring a book with her. Basically, the idea is The Biochemist and the Farmer, kind of a dialogue book. So she's all about steps. So she's all about coaching, you know. So we're going to have 58 steps or 60 steps to abundance or to health. And so she can handle the nutrition kind of chemistry, her side, and her story is so compelling. And then I can handle the same kind of step from the farm side. You know, why do you want pastured chicken as opposed to chlorinated factory chicken? And so anyway, we're working on that. Hopefully both of them will be out before Christmas. And so I got projects in the pipeline.
This goes beyond farming, which is very cool. Talk about, you had your little, you know, panic moment, or like, what could I even talk about? It seems endless. And the opportunity to collaborate with other like-minded people, that's really cool.
It is very cool that are very strong where I'm weak. I can't draw a stick man. And what Chris is, of course, he's using, you know, a bunch of sophisticated computer technology for these drawings. But boy, I mean, to be able to just see how that's going to look, it's just amazing. And Sina, that's the gal that I'm working with on this other book, she's never farmed. And so she's just this perfect, smart, bumbling consumer that got herself out of a health jam. And now basically, you know, has a pantry with no barcodes in it kind of thing. We just really complement each other in walking people through. So the kind of the idea we're working with is a continuum, and we're trying to take people where you are. Let's say that you are, you know, that you buy your food from Sheetz gas station right now, okay? And let's walk you baby step, baby step, baby step forward to paradise out this other end. So we don't make any assumptions at the front end. And all of her people, they just say, just tell us what to do. And so that's kind of our situation. You know, we live in a time now where the personal coach is a big deal. You got your wellness coach, you got your investment coach, you got your education coach, all this stuff, you know, your fashion coach, you know, your yin yang, you know, the internal design coach. And we now have this whole wellness nutritional thing is just exploding because people are sick. People are getting sick. I mean, we've got just a rampant from not just diabetes and cancer and obesity, but just people are tired. They don't feel good. They've got eczema, skin issues, all of these things. And intuitively they know something's wrong, but I'm not sure what it is. And so we're hoping that this will take people in a non-judgmental way from wherever they are on this continuum and encourage them very practically to move to a better place. People are depressed. I mean, they're in pain, opioid. I mean, the pain and the depression in our culture, I mean, that's why the Kardashians exist, because we're living fantasy lives. The average American male right now, this is an amazing one. The average American male right now between the age of 25 and 35 spends 20 hours a week playing video games. The average American male. Are we actually so bored that we have to spend 20 hours a week at your most virile time of life for an outlet? Really? I mean, 80% of Americans hate their job. 80% hate their job. And we've seen it on our farm. You know, 20 years ago when we started the internship program, everybody was 18, 19. Yeah, they were kind of between high school and college, not sure what I'm going to do. Today, 60% are 30 with graduate degrees, burned out of their Dilbert cubicle at the end of an expressway, punching numbers into cyberspace for some nameless, faceless company. And they're wanting to touch something, to feel something, do something tactile and visceral. And I get all teary even talking. I mean, the emotional trauma that people are under is just really powerful. And so this allows an outlet for it.
Well, I so appreciate you taking the time to meet with me and chat with me. It touches me personally, and I know it'll touch our community. And if you haven't been to the North Fork Valley, please come visit us. We'd love to have you there.
I'll come when the invitation comes. So, yeah, I would love to do that. And thank you for your interest in these issues. It's a special thing to put time on these issues. We need to be doing that. We need to be having these discussions because they're the staff of life.